Hi, I'm David Crowe. Thank you for tuning in to episode 118 of my weekly radio show, The Infectious Myth. You can email me at david.crowe, that's Crowe with an E, at theinfectiousmyth.com. Join the discussion and like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth, or follow us on Twitter at infectiousmyth. Listen to us every Tuesday at 2 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time on prn.fm, or download us after broadcast on iTunes or other podcast programs. Now you can also listen to any of the last five episodes by dialing Zeno Live at 1-701-719-0990 and entering 1 for the most recent episode, 2 for the next, and so on. And note that that's a U.S. phone number, so you will be responsible for any long-distance charges if you dial it. And remember, I don't know you're a listener until I hear from you. If you send me a message letting me know how you stay in touch with the show, including your mailing address, I will send you a little thank you gift. If you're interested in sponsoring this show, or have me speak at a meeting of an organization that you're a member of, please let me know. I'd be happy to discuss that with you. And now let's get to our guest, where we will talk about vaccine damage and corruption at the CDC. James Otter Grundvig is the author of Master Manipulator, subtitled The Explosive True Story of Fraud, Embezzlement, and Government Betrayal at the CDC, with a foreword by Robert F. Kennedy Jr. He is the father of a teenage autistic son and a construction engineer and investigative journalist. He's written for the Epoch Times, FTI Magazine, Law.com, and the Huffington Post on a wide variety of issues, including Hurricane Katrina, autism, and the BP oil spill. He has studied the issue of vaccine damage since 2005, when his son was 5. Welcome to the show, James.
Thank you, David. Glad to be here.
Yeah, so your son, I believe, is what got you started on investigating vaccines and led you down the trail to a man that we will soon talk about. But first, tell us what happened to your son and how you concluded it was vaccine damage.
Well, so the son was born 3 weeks early, so full term, though. Mm-hmm. So the mom is Filipino, and I'm from Norwegian background, and I'm the smallest in my family at 6 feet, 240. And there's big bones and tall people in my family from uncles and so on and so forth. And my kid was, 20 inches long 3 weeks early and 7 pounds and 1 ounce. So he was quite normal, full term, came out perfectly, developed all his milestones for the first 18 to 24 months. Nothing was a problem. And then his language started to slip at around 20 months, 24 months. And then basically one day towards December of 2002 or January 2003, he lost interest in eating completely, which was like ridiculous. He was, 90 percentile and always had been 90 percentile from the day he was born. So he's a very healthy kid. He would lie on the floor, suck his thumb, and basically be a frozen zombie for 30 or 40 minutes with his eyes wide open. He couldn't figure out what was going on with him. And I couldn't figure out what was going on with him. So it was sad to see. He would lose his taste buds. So you go from, eating everything to then eating only crunchy things, things that had sound. Like
right.
To this day, he still eats Cheerios. So right. So they're with no milk or water. So he doesn't like soggy stuff. And he doesn't like Jell-O and things of that nature. He likes things with consistency that are a little bit hard, a little crunchy. And he's not the only autistic kid like it. A lot of them are like that.
Right.
And the other thing is when you lose the ability to speak, you lose your fine motor skill, your digits, your fingers.
Right. Right.
And he used to draw every day. I have pictures of him drawing every day. He loved it. He's never done that since. So you go from a kid at 12 months to 18 months drawing every day to never doing it again.
And so presumably you were mainstream parents. You took your kid, your son, to the pediatrician. You got him vaccinated on schedule, et cetera.
Right. And the mom works at Mount Sinai Hospital, no less. So she's been there 31 years. So it's not like, how would I say this? Like, we didn't know what we were doing. We knew exactly what we were doing. And there's no blame on the pediatrician. He's just following what were the normal standards of 2000, 2005.
Right. So how closely correlated were these changes with vaccination? I mean, did you even sort of think about in that way?
There's never an event on my son. So it wasn't like you have an MMR vaccine and the next day you're, you know, a marshmallow or something. Or you have an HPV vaccine, you have some rash or fever or something bizarre happens, partial paralysis or whatever what happens. He's had none of those events. What he has had, in my opinion, is the inability to chelate metals. So you have a
chelate. Chelate. Like C-H-E-L-A-T-E, not chelate.
I meant chelate. But
yeah.
Anyway.
Right.
So anyways, chelate metals, and glutathione is one of the chemicals in the brain that are natural chelators.
Right.
And for him, it appears that every time he got vaccines, it all would build up like a winter snow without ever a thaw period where the snow would melt, or in this case, the mercury would leave his body, never quite did.
Right, and you are
the
talking...
The reason why I was able to basically understand this from a physical point of view from him was in 2006, we took him to a doctor, and he began receiving shots of glutathione directly into his vein.
Right.
And on the third trip to the doctor, my son would come home was basically completely mute. Couldn't say no, yes, not even a syllable, nothing. So from the age of 3 to the age of 6, zero coming out of his mouth, basically. And suddenly he ran to the window. He put his ears against the window, knew exactly what to do, and he cooed. And he cooed, and exactly coo, 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 coo. And he was listening to his own voice for the first time in his memory. Wow. And at that point, I said, glutathione, clearly. So the following year, we'd actually chelate him for a year to try to remove some of the metals, and it worked to a degree. But the best thing for him is I learned that, like many of the autistic kids out there, is they have a brain signaling delay, which makes sense. So if metals go into the blood-brain barrier and your brain is a big neural network and some kind of metals interfere with the move of neurons and electrical currents and whatever else, there is a signaling delay, and they've proven this at University of Pennsylvania and other places that there's a delay of signaling. So in the world of big data technology, if you are with IBM Watson and you and Watson are having a conversation, and you ask Watson, he spits out a question, you believe you're in real time with that computer. You're actually not. You're actually at a 50 millisecond delay or 1/20th of a second delay.
Right, obviously.
And that delay in the English language is a big deal because we have a thing called vowels that stretch out sounds and words.
Right.
Where if you go to Cambodia, Vietnam, they basically speak in staccato, syllables like that. And it's a different animal. So English is probably almost one of the worst languages, in my opinion, for an autistic kid to have, to try to overcome the inability to speak.
So why are vowels difficult for an autistic child?
Because they literally stretch out. They, you know, you're basically shooting out the word mom, dad.
So he has a hard time producing a long sound.
Yeah, long
but
sound.
But the consonants.
So I'll give you an example. So I'm dad, right?
Right.
Or daddy. But he calls me D because D is easier than dad. So I'm called D. Mommy's called mommy. Now mommy's called me. So D and me. And this is basically, it's easier for him to deal with. So this also proves my view of him, of what it's like to be in his shoes to a degree. It's just, why would he struggle with the word dad when he could say D? Much easier for him.
Yes.
So it's very interesting to witness this. So going back to the one treatment that really helped him going from cooing to actually speaking a little bit and then a full comprehension of his mind was through Dr. Harry Schneider, Columbia University at the time. He's now at Yale University. And it's called transcranial direct current stimulation. And in that program, you're basically wearing a head the kids are wearing a headband. We got two sponges and a 9-volt battery. And it doesn't work through osmosis. You can't sleep with it. It doesn't work that way. You actually have to engage the kid in grammar and speech and reading. And that's what helped my son get over the hump to a great degree.
And so what is, you said, I think he's 16 now. What is his status in terms of education, conversation, things like that?
So this is the paradox of my son in particular. So he's a math savant. He taught himself the Russian language, which is not related to English. He did it in a week. He did it himself. He did it using American cartoon called Dexter's Laboratory. There's 80 episodes. He knew every line of dialogue in all 80 episodes, full recall.
Right.
He spent the week on the Russian version on YouTube. This was 3 years ago. He was 13 years old. And he would slice and dice and stop and go. The information, you think, oh, what the heck's he doing? Is this part of the repetitive part of autism you think it is? And actually, he was slicing the sounds down to where he had some kind of uniform mathematical code in his head. And from there, he was able to understand Russian fully in a week. And the following week, he let those cartoons play. And he was laughing at it. So I published about that in a newspaper called Autism Spectrum News. He can do insane math. When I'm talking about insane math, I'm talking about math that Stanford professors would have to use a calculator on. He would do a square root of fraction, square root of 12 over 256, square root of 3 1/4, knows the answer immediately, less than a second. Takes him longer to write it than know the answer. He does it with all sorts of things. But one thing that holds him back is OCD, so obsessive compulsive disorder. And he's been so ABD, you know, applied behavioral analysis. He's been so drilled as a 2.5-year-old kid with autism that, or 3-year-old kid with autism, that he will not answer the questions on his own. So he doesn't test well.
Right.
So I have to, in the next couple of years, figure out how to reduce the OCD and liberate him. Because if he is the Michael Jordan of math, I want to actually not waste that on him. I actually want to liberate him.
Right, because, I mean, so many things in our society, you not only have to know what you're doing, but you have to interact with other people. You have to, if you're going to be a mathematician, you got to be able to teach it or communicate with colleagues or something. And so if you have issues on the communication side, that makes it impossible for what's in your head to get out in a useful way.
No question. So that's one thing. I mean, he has full comprehension, so he's not going to have a normal conversation with people, right? But he will be able to respond in the near future to back and forth a little bit. He does it now. But I'm talking about it. So if I'm able to reduce the OCD and heal him in other ways, then I think he's got a great opportunity to work for an IBM kind of company, you know, tech company that needs he loves computers, that needs someone to either debug programs, right?
Right.
As a quality assurance, a quality control engineer, or actually invent a new program.
Yeah, that could be. I've worked in software for a long time, and definitely some of the people who are best at writing or debugging the really highly detailed code are not the most social people in the world.
Correct.
It's they really like to focus on something. Anyway, let's start talking about how this stimulated you. I think you said in 2005 to start studying this issue. When you started to study vaccines and vaccine damage, like, what was your aim? What were you trying to find out?
I was trying to understand the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
And even with the internet, which was, you know, basically, if you think of the internet, started 1995, 2005, the internet's 10 years old. So it's basically second generation kind of stuff. It's not where it is today, right? But so there was plenty of information out there, but still not quite enough.
Yeah.
Today I'm part of research groups, you know, different autism groups, different science groups and stuff on this issue and other issues that you know, we believe, the groups do, that is, that toxins and whether in vaccines or environment actually are contributing factors to autism, no question about it. And that's what we believe.
And according to the Centers for Disease Control and all the really important people in the world, it's been proven that there's no correlation between autism and vaccines.
Well, that's what they claim. So the government always claims something. And it's a false claim with the CDC. You first of all, you have the movie Vax, which was created by Andy Wakefield, who's been basically skewered about the MMR vaccine for a long time. And then you learn in the movie Vax, if you go watch it, that you have this Bill Thompson, this CDC scientist who's still
right.
there today, who has had has been outed as a whistleblower, who now has gone into hiding or not talking to the public, and he basically said the data was cooked on the domestic side.
Okay, so let's start with that study, because we're going to talk about a man named Poole Thorsen, but there was a Ver Stratton who in 1999, apparently around that time, did a study which didn't get published for quite a few years.
Yep.
So what did that study find, and why did it take so long to get it actually published?
Well, it's 99 was 99, 2000 was the year that CDC became, I don't know, not honest with what was going on in the world. Ver Stratton out of Belgium, he basically brought up at the Simpson-Wood 2000, June 2000 meeting that thimerosal is absolutely correlated to autism.
And
the transcripts show that.
Right. Okay. So thimerosal is a ethyl mercury compound that's used as a preservative in vaccines. So it's 50% approximately by molecular weight mercury.
Yep.
And it's a lot of vaccines have had it reduced or taken out, but there is now more vaccines than ever before. But we're talking about mercury and vaccines.
Right. So it's not fully out at all in American vaccines today. So what happened was the bombshell from Ver Stratton at that secretive meeting, which is not a secret anymore, basically forced the CDC's hand. They had to go find a way to counter what Ver Stratton found. Not, first of all, so they didn't publish what he had then. Had they published that, it would have been bad news. So they went and what they've done for a long time, what they continue to do today, is manipulate the data, and they're big on messaging or propaganda or whatever you want to call it, you know, controlling the story through the media. They want to be ahead of the story. So what they did was they did a couple of things. They want to do the domestic view. There are two issues with autism. MMR, which Andy Wakefield came out in 98 with his paper, suggesting a correlation, not saying it's absolute proof, but the needs to be investigated. Of course, it wasn't investigated. They went and attacked him ever since.
Right.
And then thimerosal. So two different issues, but apparently both of these issues are major contributors to the autism epidemic without question.
And so how did they take Ver Stratton, his data, which says there's a connection, and end up publishing, I think, a few years later, saying there isn't?
So Ver Stratton worked for the CDC at the time. So here you're working for a government agency. He wasn't a visiting scientist. He was actually working for him. And that you never want to go out and manipulate the scientists completely. So what they did was they suggested him to go to speak to a Danish expert on toxins, not on toxins of vaccines, that's too controversial, but on toxins in fish and whale meat and so on and so forth, with a guy named Philip Grangene. And Philip Grangene is from Denmark, but he's been teaching at Harvard for the past 20-some years. So Philip Grangene was brought into the fold a month after the Simpson was. So in July 2000, we have emails between Ver Stratton and Philip Grangene, and Philip Grangene being the expert on toxins.
Right.
Environment and warning people that Silent Spring is basically happening throughout the world. And this was interesting coming from a Danish scientist who's been at Harvard for 20 years, and he would weigh in on certain things, but he stayed away from the vaccine end of it, knowing what a lightning rod issue it is, even back in those days. So Grangene didn't go all the way out in the branch, but he actually coached Ver Stratton to do a few things. Then the CDC changed tack. I guess they didn't like Grangene's answer at the end of the day.
Right.
Because Grangene wasn't exonerating vaccines at all.
Okay.
And so what they did was there were two different things. One is the Dr. William Thompson study with Frank DiStefano and a couple other people. There were four people at CDC, which was the Atlanta-based survey on MMR vaccines. That was strictly an MMR vaccine. A study in Atlanta, and for some reason it took 4 years to go published, which is ridiculous. You're supposed to have a certain timeline.
Right.
You're supposed to look at a certain set of data, not changing that set of data or the parameters every time. It'd be like going to a football game, then change to a hockey game, then change to a baseball game, and all the dimensions of the field changes, and that's exactly what the CDC did.
And this was the study where Thompson said that they pulled a bunch of black boys,
yes,
from it, which removed the correlation
right.
with autism.
So they got rid of half of the African American kids.
by
including ID requirements, which I think is incredibly ironic because it's exactly what politicians do to try to reduce the black vote, right? Like insist on.
it's amazing. So this goes on for quite some time. On top of that, Thompson said they actually destroyed data, which is getting that in a recorded phone conversation as a whistleblower was very damaging. The bigger deal is no one in Congress has done anything about that since 2014, since Thompson came out, or Thompson was out in 2014, right? Nothing's happened, which is shows you how crazy and political and incestuous the entire, what I call the monolith, is the deep state. So deep state includes a lot of things. It includes big pharma, it includes all the government agencies dealing with health. So from the FDA, NIH, and CDC. And you see it going on today with Zika, that they're all in lockstep agreement that Zika is like the bubonic plague or something when it's not.
Right. And the ironically, the alternative hypotheses are things like vaccines and pesticides, which are promoted by the World Health Organization and the CDC. So it may very well be that their response to the Zika virus includes spraying of more pesticides, the giving of more vaccines, which may make the whole thing worse, which actually strengthens these organizations because then there's more need to have the CDC spending money in Brazil or wherever the next.
And exactly. So instead of actually doing a real CSI investigation in Northeast Brazil, by the way, Northeast Brazil is the only place in Brazil that had the cluster of microcephaly. Nowhere else. You go 100 miles west to mosquito country where Zika is prevalent. There's no microbabies.
Right.
I've interviewed scientists. I've published articles on this. This is disgusting. Worse than this, and you don't read this in mainstream press. And now you see the mainstream press is connected to the monolith of the deep vaccine state. You realize that a month ago, if you go to Florida State University on their website, type in tapeworm antidote for Zika, it's there. But all the secondary blogs publish it, but no one, from the Wall Street Journal to the Post to the Times, Huffington Post, no one publishes the fact that they have an antidote that's off the shelf, because no one in big pharma will hear that, because it won't make money for them.
That's what it's all about. If it's patented, it makes money. Okay, so let's so we've got the Vera Stratton study. We have this other study on children around Atlanta.
Right, so that was in 2014. So in 99, Paul Thorsen came to the United States to Atlanta as a visiting scientist. That was just fate, right? Luck, fate, whatever. He just happened to be approved, came in, and he worked his way into the lives of the executives there.
Okay, so he was from Denmark. Was it Aarhus? Was he at Aarhus University?
Right, and that translates to R being a year house,
right,
as an annual, and house as house, so year house. So Aarhus University, he was there for quite some time.
Right. So in 1999, he's over in the CDC. And how did he get entwined with this vaccine
CDC
research?
Well, CDC realized that for Stratton, no matter when they published his study or when the Thompson study would be published, they needed something much quicker to fight back against the parents that and go out and put the flag atop the hill saying vaccines don't cause autism, right? Thimerosal is been exonerated. MMR has been exonerated. So what they had to go do, and what they did, was take several $1 million. They had to go to a country that had an existing healthcare database. You had Japan, Denmark, and maybe Sweden, about the three, or maybe it was the fourth one. And at the end of the day, they already had Paul Thorsen, a Dane, in-house.
Right.
And so Denmark was the country to go back and use their database. But going back and back-testing data is not a clinical study.
Right.
It is going back and back-testing data. That's all they do it in Wall Street. It doesn't mean it predicts the future tomorrow. So you go back-test the S&P 500 for the last 25 years, it guarantees you nothing about what happens in December.
But the interesting thing about Denmark is, had they not removed thimerosal from vaccines?
I was going to get to that. Right. So in 91, they removed it. And in fact, it started with a scientist in Sweden and Denmark, wasted no time. They moved it right away. Complete ban.
Right.
Right. The WHO actually was on the way to banning mercury in every every consumer product in 2013. And yet the WHO and the UN got their arms twisted by the U.S. government, right? I guess we pay the bills, and said, no, you can't do that with vaccines. It's got to remain in vaccines. So thimerosal was, again, let off the hook worldwide.
That's actually a very interesting point, because you quote in your book that the drug companies had said, you know, if you want us to remove thimerosal, we can do it. But it was the CDC that was resistant, and you kind of implied that this was because the CDC was concerned that having exposed people to thimerosal since 1930s, I guess,
yeah,
that they might, their credibility might be destroyed, they might be in line for massive lawsuits. I mean, all kinds of bad things could happen if you pull thimerosal, because that's an admission there's a problem.
Yeah, that's absolutely correct.
Okay, so
there were two letters in July of that year, of 99, no less. So basically, they hired Thorson,
right,
through Aarhus University, through his research group, which really was a bunch of BS, really wasn't his research group. So he took a bunch of his, so you can see what kind of person he was. He took a bunch of employees or scientists or researchers and PhD students and said they're all under him, when in fact, all he was doing was bringing over the money.
Right.
And he was bringing over the money, part of it because his girlfriend at the time was Dinah Shendell. And Dinah Shendell was a 20-year scientist at the CDC, researcher. She's an anthropologist by education.
Right.
She's not an epidemiologist, but she became one. And her background ties into Paul Thorson. And so even though the book's called Master Manipulator Singular, there's actually several manipulators within this story, for sure.
Yes. So the data from Denmark, the CDC, Thorson, et cetera, claimed that after they pulled thimerosal from vaccines, there was no reduction in autism rates.
Yep, that's correct.
And what was the truth of the data?
So the data was several things. The data from 1992 or 3, when they first started back testing, to 99, it showed, but the reality was, within the Danish healthcare system, they themselves were not looking at autistic kids under 4 years old. They weren't being diagnosed. So if you lowered the age, you can actually flatten the pool of autistic kids in a country.
So they changed the age at which kids were being diagnosed in Denmark, right, around that time?
So the parameters are being changed. The parameters are being changed within Denmark. And the CDC and the Danes knew this, but they didn't come out and spell it out in their studies, which is kind of insane.
You also said in your book that they deleted a 2001 class of 7-year-olds, which was the first.
Yeah, because they didn't like the results. So, like, hey, I don't like getting blown out 44-0. So let's not count the last three quarters of the game. It was only 7-0. Let's count only the first quarter. So that's basically what they did. And her name is Colleen Boyle. And Colleen Boyle is one of the other key manipulators in the story. In fact, she was the boss of Dinah Shendell. And Dinah Shendell, being Paul Thorson's girlfriend, believe it or not, today Dinah Shendell works at Thorson's old university, where he was kicked out in 2010. And Dinah Shendell works at Aarhus University as an epidemiologist. So she's collecting a CDC government pension. She's perhaps out of this country to do two things: avoid being subpoenaed, right, being served, in case that ever comes up, and it certainly might. Because I know of several cases that are, you know, in some form going to reach out to certain people at CDC. And then the other thing, I actually believe she's out there to really just monitor Paul Thorson. I don't think they're dating anymore, but I certainly think she has keeping an eye on him for the CDC. Because if he was ever extradited for the 22 counts indictment in 2011, he was ever brought to the United States.
Okay, well, let's get to that. Why would the CDC, you know, why would he be indicted? We haven't got to the fraud yet, but in terms of the monetary fraud. So what was the significance of deleting the 2001 class of 7-year-olds? Like, why were they unique?
Well, because it showed an increase.
And I think you said these were the first group of children who had been completely unexposed to thimerosal, right? That this was the first
year. And the autism was still going up.
Right.
Oh, actually, it was decreasing. So there was a direct correlation between thimerosal and this. And so it started to sort of show a different trend that the CDC didn't like.
Right, because
And the email from that person's Colleen Boyle. And so we actually got the emails. And you actually published in a book, and it's been published elsewhere by a lot of parents and stuff and different blogs. And Colleen Boyle's background is fascinating. So I have I think chapter 5, Agent Orange is New Black in the Mass Manipulator.
Right, right.
She was the PI, the principal investigator for the Agent Orange studies in the 1980s. It was supposed to be a 7-year, $71 million study, which was a lot of money in the 80s. And the CDC, 2 years early and $20 million at the table, walk away from it because they would be forced to go to the Army archives showing the ground troop movements in Vietnam versus Operation Ranch Hand, which were the U.S. airplanes that was spraying Agent Orange right. over the troops. And that would have showed a direct correlation, and U.S. government didn't want to deal with the reality that they're poisoning their own troops with dioxin.
But they eventually did admit that, but it wasn't because of anything Colleen Boyle had done, right?
No, but the worst part is no one got fired so in the CDC. So Colleen Boyle, not only does she survive a 1990 congressional report calling it the Agent Orange cover-up. Not only she survived it, but she gets promoted along the way. Today, she is the director, and this is the grotesque irony, of the National Centers for Birth Defects and Developmental Disabilities. She is absolutely probably the worst person in the United States government to ever be in charge of that for kids with defects, autism, everything else. She's absolutely the worst, for sure. And it's amazing that this is what you basically, you'd be fired in the private sector, but in public you're promoted, and that's what she was. And along the way, she was the one that found Dinah Shendell, who was, at the time was working up in Woburn, Mass, on childhood cancer clusters due to what? Due to old plants that were poisoning the well, two different wells in Woburn, Mass, which is north of Boston, and all these cancer clusters, unique cancers, and she was doing that environmental, children's health, epidemiology. And so what was amazing, so when I finally went to Denmark 2015 to look for Thorsen, and I didn't find him, but I did find the three places he lived. I know where he lives. I know who his new girlfriend is, those kind of things. I end up talking to Christian Madsen. He was one of the PI, private investigators.
Primary investigators.
Yeah, principal investigators, investigators. For the two of the five Danish studies, one on MMR and one on thimerosal, the two main studies where Thorsen's name's on it and Madsen's the lead name on both those studies. And Madsen at the time was only a 29-year-old PhD student. And Madsen flat out told me he didn't like Thorsen. He called him a lousy scientist. He called him a used car salesman. He wouldn't ever buy a car from. And he went on. And Madsen complained to his superiors at Aarhus University, and they did nothing because the money was coming in from the CDC,
right?
You know, big American cash. Why would you go, tip the cash cow, right? Why would we stop the money meter from happening?
Well, yeah, let's talk about the money, because you talk about Thorsen purchasing a $33,000 Harley Davidson motorcycle with CDC money.
Sure. I mean, that is right out of the Department of Justice lawsuit they filed against.
So he was getting all this money coming over to Denmark in order to do research, and it was ending up in his own pocket.
Yeah. Well, so what's amazing is, I'm an American citizen my entire life, born in this country. I can't get a CDC email address. Thorsen got one as a visiting scientist. He's a Danish citizen, not an American. But I mean, yeah, he goes there as a foreign visiting scientist, gets a CDC. I just find that interesting. Then he actually ends up getting what you call the CDC Federal Credit Union's three bank branches in Atlanta. He gets a bank account there. He gets introduced to Emory University. He gets a job there. He gets introduced to John Hawkins. He basically slept his way, in my opinion, or schmoozed his way through the higher-ups of the CDC. So if he was ever brought into the United States, he would certainly burn a lot of people.
Right, because he was allowed to leave the United States after things started to get hot, and it doesn't sound like there's been much of a pursuit to get him. It'd be easier to find him in Denmark.
He knows where all the skeletons are. He knows the complete fabrication lie. He could tell virtually everything about what took place and a massive cover-up and fraud that the CDC has continued. If he did that, people like Colin Boyd would likely end up in jail, in my opinion, if it was done honestly.
Right. You describe how there's an organization, is it OUH, a hospital that was somehow connected?
So Aarhus is 3.5 hours outside Denmark by train. Odense, O-D-E-N-S-E, Odense University Hospital, O-U-H, is a separate, smaller city than Aarhus. It sits in between Copenhagen and Aarhus, and Thorsen hung out there. And so he still works through the back door there. Mm-hmm. And I was able, being a New Yorker, I guess you have to be a little clever. And so how am I going to get Dinah Shandell to talk to me or Thorsen to respond to me or even the university where I knew he was working the back door? How would I get them to tell me he's actually there? Right. I actually set up a fake female email avatar, pretend I was some mom journalist, haven't published in 15 years, through some old stories, and I was able to actually open dialogue with Dinah Shandell. But the week I went to Denmark, she was in Utah, so I missed her by a week.
Oh, okay.
On Thorsen, the university said, oh, yeah. So I emailed, I'd love to interview Paul Thorsen, this and get his side story, as a female. Not using my name, but using this fake name. And the university said, oh, yeah. Thorsen said, no, he's not interested, no further contract, meaning he knows he's been burned. He knows he's a fugitive. He sort of does not want to talk to an American journalist of any kind. But the fact that the university front door, the receptionist who says Thorsen does not work here anymore, and then I get from a different group, a research group in the university saying he wants no more contact, means he still works there.
Yes, that's certainly what it sounds like.
Through a back door, for sure.
Right, right. And you kind of described how Thorsen's financial circumstances have declined because presumably he's not getting CDC money anymore. And
unless he's getting hush money, and that's possible. That could go through. I won't go through the CDC. I would go through some nonprofit organization like CDC Foundation as an example. It's an example. I have no proof of that. Go through some other organization. Go through a university that some nonprofit pays a university that ends up paying Paul Thorsen. There's still ways to pay him off to keep him quiet.
He met back. Right. He had an organization in Denmark called NANEA, N-A-N-E-A.
Yeah, so the North Atlantic, whatever it stood for.
But you describe how he wasn't properly paying people and a bunch of the employees ended up getting hit for tax fraud?
Yes, so there's a lot there. Actually, Madsen said that the entire NANEA group was a farce. He actually was – he'd have – you go back and use the one of those old screen scrapes of the World Wide Web from 2002. I actually got the entire list of NANEA employees or so-called NANEA employees. Right. Actually, most of them were always university, but Thorsen claimed they were part of his group to give the illusion that his company was bigger than it was.
Right.
His entire company was founded on CDC money. It wasn't founded on Danish money, no outside investors, nothing. They weren't producing any products. They're doing research at the end of the day. But Thorsen had this ego to stroke, and so he stroked it. So instead of working, like most people, on campus, he decided to buy a house with the CDC money off campus. And he went out and bought this nice gilded NANEA, the silver lettering that goes on outside his brick house. I actually went by it. Of course, he's since been kicked out of that house years ago. But it just shows you where his head was at. He had no talent. He was not Zuckerberg building a startup with big data.
Right.
He wasn't doing anything that a university wasn't already doing. And yet he tried to position off that he was doing something different.
And it seemed like he seemed to want, not only did he not want to do much with this money, but he didn't seem to want to share it with his staff. Right?
He definitely didn't want to share it with his staff. There's no question about it. In fact, he used people like Madsen, who was a PhD student, who the university was, I guess, paying somehow, or he was paying university. So he had as many free people as possible, used a lot of interns, and the interns were the ones, the young people, who were either still in college or right out of college, were getting burned for taxes. Because of some contracts that we have, tax codes of the United States, the consultant, contract or the W-2 or whatever, right, full-time or part-time.
Right.
And whatever that is in Denmark, he basically left those young people holding a bag of tax liability. And yet he got away with it.
Right. And so have there, you said there's an FBI investigation in the United States into his stealing money from the CDC? Is that basically?
Well, you know, there was, I guess, the FBI certainly was part of the Department of Justice, you know, going through the 22 counts of wire fraud and check writing, right? So at the end of the day, Thorsen was basically invoicing Aarhus University, but he was doing a CDC letterhead. So that means he must have gotten a CDC letterhead from Dinah Shendel.
Or
stole it, and he'd make up, you know, made up some person's name, and he would email it. Looked like it came from Atlanta. Went to university. University like, oh yeah, well, sure, we got this money from CDC. We got to pay the CDC back, right? You know, we got to pay this group back. So they paid this as if it was a third party vendor or something, and it was basically the money was wired back to one of Thorsen's, you know, three bank accounts
right.
at CDC Fed in Atlanta.
And the Danes bear some responsibility because you described how the accountant, I think at OUH, was supposed to be auditing this, never did. And when he finally looked after several years, after some questions were raised, basically just about fainted when he saw what was going on.
Right. No, they Denmark, I mean, I'm a Norwegian background, first generation. So I've worked with a lot of my cousins in the oil industry, and they are very pragmatic, meticulous in keeping audit trail records through, you know, Excel, whatever ledgers they use, right? Mm. So I was shocked to read that a CPA in Denmark wouldn't go simply just keep tabs on the flow of money in and out of the OUH, but he didn't do that.
Right.
And then when he got called the carpet, he was the one that got blamed. He was the one that got fired. He was the one that got penalized. He's the one that lost part of his pension. Yet Thorsen escapes with nothing, and Thorsen's the one to set that guy up. So it's absolutely remarkable what happened there.
Yeah, yeah. Some of these guys seem to have a golden horseshoe up their butt for all of their life, but you know, you think eventually they might run out of luck. If we could go back to the science, you talked about a Grønborg 2013 study on autism and vaccines. Yeah, can you describe that?
Sure. So there was I think they were looking at an increase that there actually is, and that's not the only first paper to come out, but it was actually showing thimerosal, a direct correlation between thimerosal and the massive increases in autism, which has gone from like 1 in 1,000 maybe in 2000 to 1 in 88 in 2010. Now it's like 1 in 33 or 45 or whatever it is today. It's
in the United States.
In the United States.
What about in Europe?
Well, that's the great question, right? So Denmark has 1/3 of the vaccines we do, and yet they're not dying from measles or anything else over there. They're not unhealthy. In fact, they're probably much healthier than American children, by far, by a long, long mile. They also ban glyphosate. Not to go off topic, but that, you know, that's a toxin, a cancerous toxin that's actually in Roundup and other weed killers. They banned it in June of 2015. That was the same week I was over there.
Mm-hmm.
So I found that very interesting. To this day, our government has not gone out and actually banned this nasty chemical, which goes into our water, into our food chain, into our air, everywhere.
Right. So what's a summary of the Grønborg 2013 study? Like, what did it find?
It found a 600% increase. It contributed in a huge way to the autism thing. So basically saying, Grønborg comes out basically saying all those Danish studies and the Thompson study are all false. We're all cooked. That they didn't show the real increases back then that they showed in 2013.
And Grønborg presumably is not associated with the CDC or
that's correct.
Okay. You also talk a little bit about aluminum. Like, this has been one of the questions, I think, Robert Kennedy, who did the introduction to your book, is basically a mercury activist, anti-mercury activist, but he seems to be opening his mind to the fact that there could be other things in vaccines. And one of those other things is aluminum, which you say you're allowed to have 0.85 milligrams of aluminum per vaccine dose.
So here's the deal.
Yeah.
My background being in construction, over years on Prussia's scale, Norway, Philadelphia, skyscrapers, buildings in New York City, I understand material science to a degree. I understand metals certainly. I wrote about the toxins coming out of Ground Zero when the World Trade Center was blown up and fell down. Aluminum is a wonderful, wonderful metal, lightweight, great for your gutters and stuff, but it's not supposed to be part of your biology, nor is mercury. It is not magnesium. It's not iron. It's not one of those things. We're born without these metals for a reason.
Right.
They interfere with everything from our DNA to our digestive system, to our nervous systems, to everything. Mm-hmm. And before the Simpson Wood, which was all about thimerosal, there was a even more secretive meeting that took place offshore in Puerto Rico 3 weeks before Simpson Wood. So in May 2000, there was this aluminum adjuvants in vaccines meeting where they had half of the people at the Simpson Wood were at this meeting, plus other people who were experts in that particular metal. And they basically admitted in the transcripts that are public record, they admitted that American people have no idea how bad this chemical really is. It would cost too much money to remove it as an adjuvant, the way vaccines are made today. That was in 2000. And so we still have this vaccine-making system that's dirty, cheap, and cost-effective only for big pharma. And nothing's been done to clean up vaccines. Vaccines are still made the same dirty, cheap way it's been made the last half century.
Yeah, regarding aluminum, I interviewed Chris Shaw, who I'm sure you've heard of him. He's a mm-hmm. Canadian scientist who's gone into a lot of trouble because he's written bad stuff about aluminum. But one of the points he made is that there is no biological system anywhere in the world that's known to biologists that contains aluminum.
That's correct.
Though it's one of the most common elements, I think it's one of the top three
8%
elements.
Earth crust and stuff like that. I have all those figures in the book.
Even though it's incredibly common, it's not used by biological systems. And yet an adjuvant is by definition biologically active, because if you take out the aluminum adjuvant, you don't get the same immune response, which proves that the aluminum is biologically active.
Correct.
So you're putting in a metal that the body's never processed before in order to stimulate the immune system in some way, and that would seem to be ripe for problems.
So if you look at mankind, right? I mean, when you have a volcanic explosion, a massive one, we get aerosols around the world. Mm-hmm. People have to, those sulfurs and metals, you know, there's metals, Earth's mantle getting blown out, right? So people have to, like, I guess, wean that through the body, filter through the body, however it works. That's fine once in a while, as long as you're, I guess, not born next to a volcano. But what I'm trying to say is the aluminum out there in a very small quantities is maybe okay for you and I and other people who chelate normally, I should say, right? That our biological systems work normally and are supposed to process stuff that are foreign to our body out of our system. On the subset of autistic kids, it obviously appears that that's not the case.
Mm-hmm.
So he's getting aluminum, you're getting thimerosal, and there's other stuff in there that you're not supposed to be getting, some very, you know, I guess, pig DNA, bovine DNA, and so vaccines are very, very dirty and very toxic.
Yeah, there's a lot of things, but it seems like aluminum is a problem. Whereas going with the vaccine dose, like if we say that the standard for aluminum is 0.85 milligrams aluminum per vaccine dose, if we increase the number of vaccines that contain aluminum, as America has been doing, like continually upping the number of vaccines children are exposed to, the amount of aluminum.
Five shots in one day, yeah, you're getting exposed to a lot as opposed to a little.
Right, and was there any biological reasoning behind the 0.85 milligrams?
There's none. Actually, I think it's got to be zero. The people that I know who are aluminum experts in the United States basically said it should be removed completely. There is no healthy level. Trace amounts is not good, especially for these kids. And since there's no biomarker tests that exist today say, well, this kid doesn't chelate well, this baby doesn't chelate well, therefore they should skip all vaccines, they give it, you know, en masse to everybody. And that's not the way it should work.
Some people want smarter vaccines, but that assumes that you can, like you say, accurately identify the children who are going to be affected. I mean, it's like saying we shouldn't give penicillin to people who are allergic to it. It's like, correct. Yeah, but how do you know? You get penicillin and you almost die, and it's like, okay, well, you should never have that again. If you're lucky, you don't die.
I met tens of thousands of people in my life. I know one person is allergic to bees. He's an ex-New York City homicide detective, which means he could take a bullet but can't take a bee sting. Right. I understand that irony. And then you have another person I know is a woman who was allergic at a very young age to alcohol. So she can't even have alcohol-based cosmetics. That's how allergic she is. She can't have a drop of anything.
Wow. Wow.
And it's just, it does the same thing as a bee sting, right? So you got some of these outliers that are allergic to this, allergic to that, and there's nothing you do about it. But why should they be exposed to bee stings and alcohol if those are going to cause them harm or kill them? It's crazy.
I mean, I guess it's like fluoridation in water. It's like everybody's going to get the fluoride, and there are some people who are going to be very sensitive. And,
well, apparently the fluoride's made in China, and so if you go to a 50-pound bag that comes in from China, there is toxic chemicals inside those bags of fluoride. So we're not getting fluoride as you think. We're getting like, oh, clean green fluoride. No, we're not getting that at all. We're getting some very dirty stuff that's probably got aluminum in it, probably got glyphosate in it, it's probably got some other chemicals in it that actually do not belong in fluoride, but we're getting it anyway.
Right. I understand that the fluoride is produced as a waste product of fertilizer production. And I know anyway, we're kind of getting off the topic, but I know in China and in India, there's many places with very high fluoride levels and extreme problems with bone, bones decaying and things like that.
Correct.
One of the quotes in your book, which I, when you were talking about Colleen Boyle, I thought this was quite a powerful quote. Was Colleen Boyle the true master? And more significantly, should she take credit for developing the CDC study template that was designed to find no association between this or that, while pointing to the bridge being out when in fact it had been photoshopped from the picture? For a puke lifer like Boyle to waste Congress money and time two times is mystifying. First, finding no links that Agent Orange poisoned Vietnam veterans, and then erasing the links from liquid metal vaccines with autism, while getting promoted all the way up the food chain to director of a major healthcare agency division. The system is not only dull and broken, but dying a slow, decaying death of irrelevancy.
Correct.
I thought that was one of the best paragraphs in the book.
It's really true in many ways. You can see what's happening, how the CDC, number one, is embarrassingly incompetent and inept with the Ebola crisis. Didn't know what it was doing. Not a clue. Might have knew what they were doing, had the A team in the front line in West Africa, but we had the D team for disaster in the United States, had no idea, didn't use the right hazmat suits, nothing. So nurses were getting Ebola virus from the patients they were treating for no reason at all, because the CDC was completely, had no program in place to do it. So is this the health agency I want to, you know, quarantine issues and protect American people? I doubt it. I do not want them representing me in any size, shape, or form of a real outbreak. I really don't.
I mean, they seem worse. They seem worse than a captive agency, because they seem to be more interested in preserving their reputation than even protecting the pharmaceutical companies.
That's correct. They're emboldened by the fact that no one got fired for Agent Orange. They're emboldened because no one got pulled on the carpet and fired by thimerosal, MMR, or true studies that were done. They're emboldened because they can fumble the Ebola crisis, but Obama does nothing in replacing Director Tom Friedman. She'd been fired on the spot. Anyone that has a performance like that would have been canned on any major corporation in the United States for sure. But he's still in power. They're emboldened because they can go out there and put up this propaganda called Zika and claim it causes this and that, and they're basically testing the market. They're testing the market to see how gullible the press is, or what the press would peddle. So I think it's a combination of two.
Well, it's the same thing as always, right? Like you come up with this new virus. It's literally A to Z. They've gone from AIDS to Zika now. And, and you say, okay, this is the new threat to the world. You spend a little bit of CDC money rushing out to Brazil or West Africa or whatever, and then you come back and say, oh, we're going to need $1 billion next year to work on our Zika virus program or something like that. And of course, the right. pharmaceutical companies love it because it's like, oh, we're going to need a vaccine. We're going to need this or that, right?
Well, so, you know, it's like vaccines are the only cure in the world for anything. Like you break your bone, get a vaccine. You drown, get a vaccine. I mean, this is what is it is so ridiculous. So going back to the tapeworm antidote for Zika, while I was reading last week, it appears that a heavy dose of C vitamins would actually suppress and make Zika symptoms go away.
Well, if we need to get rid of Zika, because for decades they said Zika has no pathogenic capacity.
Correct.
It can't cause disease. And then all of a sudden it's causing microcephaly, and they're ignoring every other possible cause of microcephaly.
You know why anthrax and Ebola are related? They're like the most lethal agents on the planet, right? In their natural form.
I would disagree with that, but
I talk about if you're up close, if you get Ebola or you
supposedly
or you inhale anthrax, you're pretty, and you don't get any help. Your days are numbered, in my opinion. What was interesting? Neither one of those spread really easily.
No,
that's the key. So even after 9/11, with the anthrax scares, where all this weaponized anthrax, this dust particles in the envelopes, it might affect the HVAC system, but it only killed a total of five people.
If you dig up the soil in Canada, you will find anthrax just about everywhere.
You're right, and you find it in Russia and everything.
Yeah.
I'm talking about the weapons grade part of it.
Right, but still, I mean, if there was anthrax in the soil and it was deadly, then children playing in the dirt should be getting anthrax all the time, right?
No, absolutely.
Yes.
But they're not.
Anyway, we've run out of time, so is there anything that you would like to add to this very interesting discussion?
Yeah, so the last thing is, this week on the 14th of October, which is this Friday, the CDC had a two-month window for people to review and notice a proposed rulemaking. This is regarding the CDC's ability to name what an infectious disease is, like measles, as a new plague, and then have a quarantine. And the quarantine would be their ability to apprehend people indefinitely, you know, pull them off trains if they have the slightest sniffle, planes, buses. And this is a paragraph that would basically eviscerate the American Bill of Rights, all of it.
Right. So people who say, I don't want to get the flu vaccine, they could just like stand at a major train station and pull you off or an airport or something and say, you're not going anywhere. You're spending the next 2 weeks in jail.
And you can't call under those rules. You wouldn't be able to call anybody. You don't get like one phone call because I've been arrested.
Right.
No, I want to get represented by a lawyer. You get none of that.
Right.
So this is a complete destruction of the U.S. Bill of Rights. Totally. And Congress is not even getting a chance to debate this. And if this goes through, the United States got some serious issues.
Yeah, well, it is concerning. Maybe I should talk to somebody about that. If you have any suggestions for future guests, and send me an email after the show.
Okay.
James, thank you for joining me today. I really appreciate you taking the time to do this, and I will put a link to your book in the show notes, and encourage people to read it, because we only went through a little bit of it, but it's a really fascinating story and very scary about just how corrupt and broken the system is. I agree.
Great. Thank you for your time, David.
Okay. Goodbye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to episode 118 of The Infectious Myth. If you have a comment, question, or suggestion for a future guest, please email me at david.crow@theinfectiousmyth. Like us or join the discussion at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth or follow us on Twitter @infectiousmyth. Until next week, goodbye.